I'm Barry Latzer. I'm here to discuss the causes of crime. Criminologists blame everything on socioeconomic adversities. Poverty, of course, residential segregation, female-headed households, high unemployment, and socially isolated large-scale communities. These factors are relevant. So is gender relevant? Males do 10 times the violent crime of females. Young males, past 18 and before 40, do the bulk of violent crimes. If we only look at the last 5 years at most, which is what criminologists do, then we might get a misleading picture. Criminologists need history, and that's what I do in my research and writing. So when we look at the history of crime, what we see is that various groups that immigrated to the United States or migrated within the United States had very different violent crime rates, some extremely high, some quite low. And these differences actually had very little to do with socioeconomic adversities. They were all poor. Had residential segregation, high unemployment, socially isolated communities. From the late 19th century and into the 21st, some social groups had much higher violent crime rates than others, even though they were equally adversely situated. And that's the key to this. The Jews, the Japanese, the Germans, the Scandinavians that immigrated here all had low violent crime rates. By contrast, the Irish, the Italians, the Mexicans, and believe it or not, the Chinese, at least in the late 19th and early 20th century, all had high violent crime rates. And most importantly for today's discussion, white Southerners, and especially Black Southerners who migrated within the United States from the South to the big cities of the North, they had extremely high violent crime rates. So what's going on here? These social groups have subcultures who engage in a violent crime in response to what are perceived of as slights, insults. And it doesn't matter whether they're real, he's being offended, dissed, insulted. He's willing to resort to his gun and engage in violence. You looked at their girlfriend the wrong way, they will resort to violence. And it's interpersonal quarrel and conflict that causes the vast bulk of violent crime. I am talking about rape, murder, manslaughter, and especially what they call aggravated assault, where you use a weapon and damage to the victim. Jews, Japanese, Germans, and Scandinavians, low violent crime rates. Even though they're in America, they have access to guns like everybody else. Criminologists need to take this subculture of violence explanation into account. And they don't want to because many people think it's racist, it's insulting to the group. But I would argue we're talking about a culture, not a race. The subculture of violence is influenced by cultural factors. That means the beliefs, the values, the behaviors of a group. It's not racial. You can take people who are black-skinned, put them in England, put them in Africa, put them in Haiti, and they're going to have very different beliefs, attitudes, and behaviors. Race is not determinant. Culture is determinant. Therefore, it's not correct to say that subculture of violence theory is racist. It's not based on race. It's based on culture.
Why is the common wisdom that economic conditions affect violence and crime rates?
The general public believes that crime is motivated by a need to steal. When you're poor, Maybe during the Great Depression, that was true. The United States has become much more affluent. Nobody is literally starving to death. Violent crime is not motivated by these economic determinants. But violent crime, murder, rape, assault, that's motivated by interpersonal quarrels, not economics.
Given that culture changes slowly, generation to generation, how do you explain the major cycles in violent behavior?
That's excellent, Larry, because that shows the limitations of the cultural explanation. Let's take the big crime boom that started in the late 60s and ran to roughly the mid-1990s. Probably the biggest violent crime boom in American subcultures of violence don't change that rapidly, and therefore that couldn't possibly explain it. And it doesn't. So what does explain that crime boom? There are about three factors that do. First, demographics, the baby boom. Youth is certainly a key correlate of crime. The more youth you have, the more violent crime you're going to get. Simple as that. And so this explosion in the youth population was a key factor in the great crime boom. I call it the crime tsunami of the late 60s to mid-90s. Second factor, the criminal justice system had gone flabby. There was a big belief in rehabilitation in the early 60s and in the 50s. And we sort of let our guard down. Police didn't make as many arrests. Sentences were much lighter. So at the same time, the baby boom is increasing crime. You have this weakened criminal justice system that's punishing people more lightly, more lenient. Third big factor was a huge migration of African Americans from the South to the cities of the North, and this occurred in different stages. It happened in the 1920s, the 1940s, starts again in the 1960s. And this big migration of African Americans to Northern cities was a big contributor to high violent crime rates. Remember, African Americans were one of the groups with high subcultures of violence, and they brought that subculture with them from the South. Anyone who lived in a big city in the 70s knows this. I lived in New York, I know it. People in Philly, they knew it. Chicago, Boston, Detroit, certainly, absolutely Detroit. A sub-issue was the cocaine epidemic, but that didn't start till the late 80s, and the crime wave was already well underway. By then, the system had toughened up, and the punishments were harsher, and that was the beginning of the end. That's my explanation, and the question is really perfect because it shows that even the subculture of violence theory cannot fully explain why crime rises and falls.
How do you explain the explosion in crime rates since COVID?
I think police were holding back. They were afraid to engage with suspected offenders. And the demonstrations with the George Floyd incident, the police were further diverted because there were so many protests and they were so massive that police normally assigned to deal with violent crime were assigned to protests. The police drew back. They weren't proactive the way they normally have been in the last few decades. They weren't pursuing suspects.
What do you think of Giuliani's implementation of James Q. Wilson's broken window philosophy?
I was never fully persuaded that broken windows worked. Disorder is important to quell. Low-level offenses must be pursued by the police and prosecutors. In fact, I just wrote a piece critiquing the new prosecutor in Manhattan for refusing to pursue these low-level offenses. Disorder matters. If you don't arrest people who are urinating in the streets, dealing drugs even at low levels, drinking and making noise all night long, if you don't pursue these low-level offenses, then what happens is you get disorderly communities. And disorderly communities do breed serious crime. I do agree with Wilson and Kelling. But it's not sufficient. High crime has to be dealt with on its own and not just disorder. High crime has to be dealt with strictly. And I don't mean that sentences have to be lengthened, but the police have to do their job. They have to find these offenders, arrest them, and then they have to be processed and punished. That's the most important thing to do. Disorder is also important to get under control because it contributes to the decline of communities and cities. I was in New York in the 1970s. I remember when you had disorderly behavior in New York. It keeps the law-abiding people fearful and reluctant to go in public spaces. That has a big ripple effect. People aren't going to go to the shows, restaurants, and movies. I'm not sure that arresting these low-level offenders, and by the way, they're not going to stay in jail very long for these crimes. I'm of mixed mind on it. I don't accept the theory that clamping down on disorderly behavior prevents felonies, but I think is important to do in its own right.
People walking in the neighborhood reduces crime, but this disorder reduces walking traffic.
I agree. They need to make sure that the public spaces are safe, and then people will walk in those communities, and that does discourage crime. More law-abiding people in an area does mean fewer disorderly types.
How do you explain the sharp differences in violent crime rates between Chicago, Detroit, and Baltimore versus New York City?
There seems to be some contagion effect that takes place locally. Young people copy one another. They copy their fads, their misbehaviors. In some cities, when some young people begin engaging in crime and disorderly conduct, other young people copy them and do the same thing. And that seems to spread. That seems to me to be the best explanation. And once that copying hits a tipping point, then it explodes and it seems to get out of control.
The public learns about police work from television, shows like The Wire and Law and Order. Are these shows realistic?
Not much, because police work is boring. If they portrayed all that boredom, you'd flip the channel to something else. Rarely are cases resolved with such finality as on television. It just doesn't happen that way in the real world. Most crimes go unsolved. Large numbers go unreported. Shooting, the overwhelming number of police never use their service revolvers on the job, except in the target practice. Television guys are shooting all the time, and they're perfect shots. That's unrealistic. So that's my beef with the dramatizations. It sort of misleads people about what's going on in the real world of policing.
Our current approach to punishing criminals doesn't appear to work very well. How can we do a better job?
My proposal for certain populations where there's high rates of recidivism, mainly people who are released to parole from prison, where to use electronic monitoring more to substitute for incarceration. It provides some monitoring of the offender, whereas under the current system, the overstretched parole officers can't monitor each and every prisoner. Technology could be the wave of the future, especially if we ever develop the technology to determine the behavior of the subject, not just the location. The current technology is like the GPS in your car. It can determine the location, but it can't really determine the behavior. Once we reach a point where we're technologically able to determine behavior, we'll see replacement of incarceration with high-tech electronic monitoring. So that's the future. People are very disenchanted with the prison system. We don't have a good replacement. Maybe it's technology.
Rural Sicilians and rural Irish moved to urban New York City, Chicago, and Boston. Was the rural to urban shift important in this story of violent crime?
When it comes to the subculture of violence, rurality is more of an influence than urbanity. Back in the 19th century, cities had less violent crime than rural areas. But when a rural group with a subculture of violence, take the African American, moves to the big cities, I argue that they'll transport that subculture of violence with them. It's the same for that Sicilian population that we were talking about just a minute ago. Rural areas do have high violent crime rates. In the first half of the 20th century, New York City had lower than average violent crime rates. The rest of the country was higher than New York City. Cities tame violent crime, at least that was the argument made in the 19th century. In the late 20th century, we assume it's just the opposite, that rural areas have lower crime, violent crime rates. And they do. In fact, the pecking order is urban area highest, suburbs, rural areas lowest of all.
How do you explain the sharp reduction in violent crime over time among the Irish, Italian, and Chinese Americans?
Class trumps culture. When people move up the social ladder, when they become middle class, more affluent, they shed their violent crime culture. If you look at middle class African Americans, their crime rates are much lower than lower income African Americans. Affluence definitely reduces violence because you'd be out of your mind if you have a family, a decent job, and a decent wage. You'd be crazy to hold up a liquor store. So affluent people are not going to engage in violent crime. It would be self-destructive.
If you were put in charge, how would you change public policy?
Woke prosecutors, as they're calling them. Policies are misguided. Disorder in cities is a disease. It ruins communities. Arrests have to happen. You simply can't look the other way and pretend this crime isn't occurring. And we see with the West Coast cities, Seattle, San Francisco especially, what happened when prosecutors didn't want to prosecute. We must attend to disorder, even though these are low-level offenses. The punishments here do not contribute very much to mass incarceration because they're very light punishments. These are people who get a couple of months in a jail and don't ever see a prison. We have to stay the course when dealing with more serious offenses. We have to use our police wisely. We have to do hotspot policing. These interventions with gangs might work and intercept the firearms. Defunding the police, that's just an utter disaster. My formula is more of the same. I don't have any panaceas. However, electronic monitoring and technology can be very beneficial for the criminal justice system, and we should pursue that aggressively.
Is it true that prisons are filled with low-level drug users and not violent criminals?
55% violent crime. The numbers for drug offenders is 14%. Of the 14%, 10% or so are drug dealers. They're people who were selling. They were in the business. So only a small percent, 4% or less, are drug possessors. That is, they weren't selling. However, even that number is high because many of these drug possession cases are simply cases that had problems and had to be pled down to drug possession. Police make an illegal seizure of the drugs, and they can't convict them of drug sales. They'll take the conviction for drug possession. The assertion that the prisons are filled with low-level offenders, mainly drug offenders, is false. Michelle Alexander, who made this argument back in the day, you know, New Jim Crow, I just explode those arguments in my next book. They're totally false. The people in prisons are there because they've done very serious offenses over and over again. The argument that you have some kid smoking dope and he goes to prison, not true.
Do you expect to see a sharp drop in and violent crime among the African-American community in the decades ahead?
Not in my lifetime, perhaps, but decades and decades from now, Black violent crime is going to be a historical phenomenon only. Who talks about Irish violent crime today, Larry? Or Italian violent crime, for that matter, except for a few mafia movies that perpetuate the stereotypes, right? And it's going to be the same way for African Americans. I feel very optimistic on that score.
You mentioned that there are subcultures that are easily angered and resort to violence. Can we educate to dissuade them that this violent response is problematic?
Anger management training kind of thing? You'd have to do it at such a mass level that it wouldn't be workable. It's a long, slow process. But the best thing that could happen is affluence. Affluence seems to do the trick. They move up the social ladder, they eschew violence, and the culture changes. That's the end of that subculture of violence. I don't think you could do it through education alone.
I end each episode on a note of optimism. Barry, what are you optimistic about as it relates to violent crime?
Well, we have a huge gun problem, and I'm not so optimistic about that. The NRA would say guns don't kill people, people kill people, and there's a truth to that. I'm optimistic about African American moving to the middle class and eschewing violence. I think America, it sounds almost corny nowadays, but it is still a land of opportunity as long as our economy expands and as long as we don't discriminate against these groups. They will have opportunities, and probably not my lifetime. I'm an old man already, but it will happen. It took three generations with the Irish and the Italians.